Wells. I'm joined today by our regular guest co-host, Roger Goldman. Roger, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Renee is on assignment this morning, and she is missing out on this beautiful weather here in Park City. How'd you enjoy the weekend, Roger?
It was a spectacular weekend. It was what we call a Chamber of Commerce weekend. And there were, as I went out and watched all the people hiking, biking, it was one of those reasons that you know why people live here.
Yeah. Well, the old adage that we all say over and over, you know, you come for the winter, but you stay for the summer. And those summer weeks have officially begun. So welcome to Mound Money. We've got a great show for you. Our first guest is going to be Cal Turner Jr. He's the author of My Father's Business, The Small Town Values That Built Dollar General into a Billion-Dollar Company. I think most of us have seen Dollar General stores, and Cal wrote the story about how his father built that into the 1,000-plus store empire that it is.
Next, later on today, we will be hearing from Eric Silvick, who is the owner of Terra Nova of Utah. And this is a guest I'm particularly excited to hear from because he develops zipline riders. And he invented and developed the zip rider, which allowed him to connect two faraway points in the Park City Mountain Resorts. And I'm going to want to know if he'll install one in my house.
That would be fun. And you do live on top of a hill, Roger.
Following that, we'll have Ben Castro, who is the vice president of Zions Bank, and will talk to us about private banking and other issues facing the banking world.
You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW. Please stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
A longtime supporter of KPCW, Jan's Mountain Outfitters sells and rents mountain bikes and road bikes. Our bike shop provides bike fitting, parts, tunes, and repair service. Jan's Fly Shop is stocked with fishing gear and offers guided fishing excursions and lessons, serving Park City for over 30 years. 649-4949 or jans.com.
Welcome back to Mound Money. On the phone with us, we have Cal Turner Jr. He's the author of My Father's Business, The Small Town Values That Built Dollar General into a Billion-Dollar Company. Welcome, Cal.
Thank you very much. This is Doug, I believe.
This is Doug. Yes, sir.
All right, Doug. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, we're delighted to have you. As I mentioned in the open, you know, most of us, I think virtually all of us in the audience have seen and likely been in a Dollar General store. But tell us about the early years. What was your father's vision when he started Dollar General?
Oh, my, Doug. The Turners got off of the farm into retailing, and it was my grandfather, J.L. Turner, who was the origin of our company, and he and my father jointly established a wholesale company in a very small town in Kentucky, Scottsville, in 1939, 3 months before I was born, and realized after the Second World War that a wholesaler was doomed if he didn't have a direct connection with the eventual customer, so they started opening stores. And I have written this book from the vantage of 15 years retired from the company, and I look back on all that happened, and I try to share it with the reader in a way that might help the reader to get on with life anytime there is good or bad in life for that person, because as CEO of that company, I share a lot of stuff that can go on in a family business that grows into a Fortune 500 company.
Good morning, Mr. Turner. This is Roger Goldman. One of the issues that you just touched on that I thought was interesting in the book was the difficulties of combining business, particularly a publicly traded business, and family relationships. Was that one of the harder things for you to deal with during the course of your career?
Roger, there's a chapter in the book titled The Toughest Decision of My Life. We were a public company. We were in great difficulty because we had overexpanded the business. And one CEO had to face the fact that the COO and he did not agree when the company had to change. And I made life's toughest decision and terminated my brother, Roger. And I share that. I share in this book my angst at having that kind of decision making to go through, and I'm really trying to help any reader to process life better based on the long experience I had in the growth and development of that of the family and the family business, and then the company, which became a Fortune 500 company. But man, mixing family and business can have all sorts of surprising twists and turns.
It often does. And you know, we're a town of small businesses here in Park City. We've got a couple large ski resorts, very famous ski resorts here in town.
Then, I like Park City.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear you've been here then.
I've been there. I owned property there at one time, and I came out there on a regular basis for skiing. I just love it out there.
Well, we're glad to hear that, and hopefully you get a chance to come back out sometime soon. I want to talk about what you were just mentioning, which is the most difficult decision in your life, you know, letting your brother go from the company. And there are a lot of small businesses here, and many of them are mom and pop, and you know, husband, wife, and maybe second generation. Their kids are in the business as well. What are some lessons that you learned from that difficult process of letting your brother, leading your brother out of the company?
Well, I learned many things. I learned that management has to be aligned as to the change that's needed in a company or in any business. And we happened to have the issue of sibling rivalry, and we couldn't agree at a time. Management had to agree, and somebody had to lead. So what happened to us is that we overexpanded and got into trouble, and we couldn't get out of trouble with both of us staying in the company. And so the real problem of leadership at the top of our company got addressed. A company that grows as rapidly as ours did goes through a lot of change and probably more change that's needed. And sometimes it gets beyond the family control dynamic that is so needed for the company to continue succeeding. So it's really tough when business success and family success seem to compete.
One of the things I actually enjoyed about the book, and I know these were painful episodes for you, was that in some ways it read like it reminded me of some kind of television drama about family dynastic conflict, because we were just talking about your brother. Within a short period of time, your father was also I think it's fair to say pushed out of the company. And again, that also, as you read the book, both the business needs and the personal pain come through.
I want to share it because I think my doing that can help the reader, Roger. I believe that's Roger. Yes.
I think so, too. And that's one of the things I enjoyed most about the book, was the real sort of nature of how these challenges came up and had to be dealt with. You know, one of the subtitles of the book is Key Values, or is about the values that this company was built on. And I'd like to take a minute and let's talk about how would you characterize sort of two or three or four key values that you think are the bedrock of this company's success?
Well, to me, the company is about three different generations of Turners. The values of the original J.L. Turner, my grandfather, who, by the way, only had a third grade education at the age of 11. He had to take over the mortgaged family farm when his father was tragically killed, and he had three younger siblings. So the success of the family was his agenda. So the two values that came from Luther Turner were hard work, and number two, Luther Turner, because of his limited education, assumed that everyone he met would be smarter than he was, and he should learn something from everybody he met. Now, that's the making of a leader, though that 11-year-old lad, no one would have guessed, on that mortgaged Macon County, Tennessee farm, would one day start a company that would be a Fortune 500 company. Hard work and learning from others. And then from my dad, I got the value. In a small town, everybody knows you and what you're doing. So a small town has a way of encouraging good behavior. And my dad thought you really need to run the business like a church. And when I came into the company and he said that to me, "Son, I think you need to run a business like a church." I said, "Oh no, Daddy, I've been on church committees and all the church politics, and if we don't run Dollar General better than the church, we're doomed."
What do you think your father meant by that?
Well, he meant really the principles of the good book. That's what he meant. You have to do right and you have to do well in business. To him, that was running it like a church. He hadn't been as active in church work as I had growing up.
And all right, so broad strokes, kind of the church work is what he meant, and you knew kind of maybe the sloppiness and the bureaucracy that can be part of that with the caution. Let me ask
you,
in your book, you talk about some of the battles that you had with the unions, and you know, interestingly.
Oh,
you know, coming from your father saying run it like a church, and there's different aspects of a church, but one of them is caring for everybody. How do you balance the business needs of the company and taking care of employees? And what was your father and your view of how the union could be or maybe was not a partner in that?
Boy, that's a good question. The company evolved from one generation to the other, and the orientation toward unions evolved as well. My father had great difficulty with even the thought of a union, and I'm pretty graphic in my description of how he maneuvered versus unions. When I came into the company, I was trying hard to have our employees to be taken care of as if they were part of our family, and that was my higher calling than union or not or whatever. It was for us to take care of our employees and include them in a family business. And when Dollar General really opened its heart and mind to all the employees to help us figure the business out together and share the success together, then there wasn't any issue of a union.
What do you think your father's issue was with the union? Why you said earlier he was anti-union. Why do you think he was anti-union?
Well, my father was a boss. And a boss needs full control. And I knew that progress in our company would require our getting beyond the boss mentality and to open it up to employees and to create a culture that includes everyone and helps everyone grow and develop. that kind of culture is the best antidote to employees even thinking about a union, because they're part of our family and we take care of them. So mine wasn't so much an anti-union bias as it was a pro-employee bias.
One of the interesting things, another interesting thing about the book is some of the colorful stories that come out in conjunction yeah. with the company's issues with the union, such as I believe there's a sequence where there's discussion of something as vile as a contract to kidnap your son.
Yes. Well, you have read the book. Yes, indeed. That was a terribly emotionally laden time. Excuse my big words, but I should just say that was a time of pure hell for us to go through.
Yeah, why don't you give our readers a little background of how that confrontation took place? Was that in the context of a strike?
Yes, we had in the company's history, there was at that time one warehouse that supplied all of the stores, and we had two union elections, one for the drivers, and the drivers voted the union in. Then we had the election of the warehouse workers who voted the union out. But the difficulty of resolving contract issues for the drivers put them on strike to shut down the only warehouse in the company. And it was almost that we were fighting for all of our warehouse employees against the so that they could continue their job and the company could continue its business. And we did get a ruling that empowered private hauling of all merchandise for the company, so the company actually stopped that function of hauling its own merchandise at that time. But in that process, there was a lot of intimidation. There was a lot of rough stuff, and our little town in South Central Kentucky had a security force 3 to 4 times the size of the police department. And our home was shot into, and yes, there was a kidnap contract on our 5-year-old son, and it was hard. It sure is hard for you to keep your head on straight when others around you are pulling dirty tricks like that.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to build relationships, and ultimately, you know, the employees are the face of the company, and so I could see where that would be really challenging. I want to switch gears now. In the teaser, I shared with the audience that Dollar General has over 1,000 stores. In fact, the number is probably closer to 15,000, isn't it?
Exactly. And by the way, I can't speak for the company today. I've been retired for 15 years.
Fair enough.
And
thank you for that disclosure. But I want to go back because, you know, actually there's some parallels here. My father ran a small grocery store, not, you know, different than a Dollar General, but very, but some similarities. And it's a tough business. You really have to be. It's all about operations. It's about operating well. It's about marketing well. And your grandfather, Luther, started the business. Now, fast forward to 1962. You're graduating college. Your dad's running the business at this point. And at that point, you guys had 75 stores. So it had really taken 2 generations to get to 75 stores. What was the inflection point for the company? When did that happen? When did you guys go from being a regional player to being a national powerhouse? And what drove that transition?
Well, from that, to take it from that time in 1962, my graduation from Vanderbilt, until my retirement, the company from that time had grew to having about 6,000 stores and sales of about $6 billion. So that I suppose my college graduation was one inflection point, but the real growth impetus of that company was actually in 1988 when we got we determined which brother was going to lead the company, and the company got serious about growth. And the 90s were the highest percentage growth of that company in my time there.
I know that
it's hard to span that much history for you.
I know that you've been gone from the company for a while, but obviously with your experience in retailing, I'd be interested in how you see the future. Dollar General, as I understand it, was based on, you know, largely local relationships and largely in smaller markets. With the, you know, influx of online retailing, what's going to happen to a company like Dollar General? Is there a role for that kind of retailer going forward?
Well, I think I can answer that from history, and so I'm not speaking about the present, but what we saw as an opportunity was to be a retailer to small-town America and to provide the consumable basics, the things people use and use up at a low price, and to be in stock near the customer. And that model, I believe, can sustain itself versus Amazon or anybody else, because we have already fulfilled the sale ahead of making the sale. We're in stock close to the customer. Did you know that that company today, and I'm bragging on them, that company today has a Dollar General store within 75% of the population of the continental United States.
Yeah, it's really staggering just how many, you know, when you think about how many stores 15,000 stores is.
And they're out in little towns. You can there's great business opportunity in the Park City, Utahs, or the Scottsville, Kentuckys, or any small town.
Yeah, part of that opportunity is the big retailers have kind of not thought about that. You know, it's interesting. Dollar General got its start in rural America. So did Walmart, and you see what the behemoth is that Walmart that has become. If you're just joining us, our guest this morning is Cal Turner Jr. He is the author of My Father's Business, The Small Town Values That Built Dollar General into a Billion-Dollar Company. Cal, we only have a few minutes left, but I do want to ask, you know, what was the driver, what was the motivation for writing the book? What are the nuggets that you're hoping the reader will take away from it?
Well, I have spent 37 and a half years with one company at the top of that company. I have seen major change. I have seen success and failure, and the company has done well. I am indebted to wonderful mentors that I've had in my life, and this book is my attempt to mentor the reader about perhaps how he or she can get through those tough times in life, because I share from heart and mind the inside story of the battles and the successes and the failures and what I was thinking and what I went through. And it does read somewhat like a novel, but it's real life out there. And all of that was my attempt to take ministry into business. I think you can do good for people in business enterprise. And so, in a sense, I guess we did try to out-church the church.
One of the things you talked about a few minutes ago, you mentioned your father had a boss's mentality. And as you sort of took over the company and things changed, what management techniques did you use that were different from your father's, particularly with respect to the distribution of responsibility?
Well, I went in and knew that I was the boss's son, and I had to overcome that with everybody. So I went in laughing at myself. We know how I got this job. I'm the boss's son. By the way, I've done most of the jobs all of you do in this company, and I am not good at a single one of them, but that makes me respect you. I know, as CEO of this company, over his head, that I need you. I need your insight. And if you'll help us figure this business out, we'll share the success with you. I tried for the style of a leader, and I had the loving support of the boss, my father, right there cheering me on. And when we turned that company over to the employees, we actually did a 180-degree turn from the business model that my father started the company with.
Cal, I got goosebumps when you were saying that. And the reason is, I love what you said earlier about Luther and the value of humility. And I think that's so important. I think business leaders sometimes miss that. It was high school graduation here this last weekend, and my daughter was fortunate enough to give a talk. And on her own, her topic
congratulations to her father.
Well, congratulations to her, and thank you for that. But on her own, I had no idea what the speech was going to be about. And her speech was on the value of humility and how, you know, this is Park City is an affluent town. And if you're not careful, growing up in this, you can look at yourself and maybe think you're better than other people. And you cannot learn from other people if you think that you're better than them. And I love how you talked about, I did every job in the company, and frankly, I wasn't very good at them. And I think that's a very powerful message to send people. It makes you very approachable, and I think being approachable in business is important. We have time for one last question, and I want to go back to your grandfather, Luther. He would be wildly impressed at what you, your father, your brother, have done with Dollar General and the managers there today. What do you think, if he could tweak one thing about what Dollar General is today, what do you think he'd like to tweak?
Well, Luther was there for his family, and the success of his family would be something he would be happy about. I don't know that he would want to tweak anything. If a Turner family business, which I consider Dollar General to be, if a Turner family business is taking care of customers in the stores, and if it's listening to employees, Luther Turner would not try to change a thing.
I love that answer. Thank you. Our guest this morning has been Cal Turner Jr. He is the author of My Father's Business, The Small Town Values That Built Dollar General into a Billion-Dollar Company. Cal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And stay tuned. Mountain Money will continue after this short break.
Hi, this is Greg Cropper of Jones Waldo Park City, a Park City law office. I've been a big fan of KPCW since its first broadcast back in 1980. Jones Waldo has been representing clients from Summit and Wasatch Counties since 1875. You can find us at joneswaldo.com.
Hi, I'm Tony Tyler with Columbus Pacific Development, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Our newest residential project, Apex Residences, is a collection of 63 slope-side townhomes and flats located at the apex of Canyons Village at Park City Resort. Information about Apex Residences can be found online at apexparkcity.com or 435-429-APEX.
Hi, this is Whitney Ryan from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We are really pleased to have in the studio this morning Eric Silvik, who is the owner of Terra Nova of Utah. And Eric has a business that developed zip riders, which are sort of upscale zip lines. And I'm really looking forward to hearing a little bit about the business. Good morning, Eric. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And tell us a little bit about what inspired you to get into this zippy business.
Well, originally it was really the main idea was to try and help the ski industry develop their summer business. It was a concept that actually I worked with Vern Greco and John Cumming with, and the main goal was to generate more revenue, more visitorship to the summer for ski areas. Since then, it's spread out into other other locations, other industries, and other products.
So you're obviously doing work here at Park City Mountain. What other big-name resorts is your company helping put zip lines in for?
Well, we installed the Zip Tour at Sundance. We have Park City's ride. We have the two rides that are at the Canyons. We have the two rides that are at the Utah Olympic Park. And then we've installed rides in Siberia and Brazil. We have three in South Korea. We have rides in Japan. So we expanded out into an international market about 10, 12 years ago.
And is there something different about your system that makes you guys the zip line installer of choice?
Well, yeah, we have technology. We have about 17 patents now since 2001 that we've developed for the zip line industry, the rescue industry as well. And really what it is a braking technology that allows us to do much longer and much steeper rides. And the goal of our product initially was that if we wanted to do a ride system from the top of, say, Park City to the bottom, that we could potentially do that in 2, 3, maybe 4 rides. If you use traditional zipline technology, which is just a pulley on a cable, it would take probably 30 to 40 different spans to get you down the mountain. But because we can do steeper, longer rides, it decreases the amount of spans, decreases the amount of time out on the ride, decreases the amount of labor needed, and makes for a more thrilling experience.
Can we talk a little bit about the technology? I know that I've been on zip lines in certain countries where the braking technology consists of a large man catching you as you come into the platform, which doesn't strike me as perhaps the most efficient method, for a large line. Like, tell me how it works a little bit.
Well, basically, it's to be a little technical, it's just a cantilever brake. It's a very simple concept where the farther out on the cantilever, the more braking you're applying to the cable. So we actually use the cable as part of the braking mechanism. There's a brake pad that pushes up on the bottom of the cable. So the farther out on the brake arm, the bigger the lever arm, the more braking. The beauty of this technology is that it takes the weight of the rider out of the equation, more or less, meaning you don't have to adjust the brake for different weight riders. So that was really key to the success of the product. You don't have to weigh somebody and adjust the brake according to their weight. The way the math works, the physics work, one brake setting theoretically works for a wide range of riders, and that makes it easier to maintain. It's very simple technology. So you
come up with this idea, this better technology. You patent it so other people can't copy it for a couple decades. And so now you have technology, you have an idea. How did you go from that to a company? How did you build a company out of that?
Well, came up with the concept of possibly initially putting zip lines in at Park City for John Cumming, and Vern Greco was the president at the time, and came up with the technology, the way to do it, proposed it, and John basically said that he wanted it in. So really, John was pivotal in the success, initial success, because the startup costs were are substantial. So basically, he invested in the concept, the idea, and we built the first ride.
Did he become an investor in the company?
He did not. No.
Good for you, because that's probably something you would agree to. Hey, we'll let you put it in, but the Cummings family wants to own 25% of your company.
Right. Well, I was an employee at the time when I worked for him, when we developed this. And the timing was such, with 9/11 occurring, money was tight. No one knew if anyone was going to show up for the Winter Olympics that year. So I ended up having to take I asked, and I took the technology and started developing it on my own at my own expense at home. By the time we got through the Olympic year, it was a phenomenal year. The guys at Park City did an incredible job. And then the project was restarted. And by Labor Day of that year in 2002, we had an operating ride. So, yes, it was timing, and it was not probably the type of business that John was interested in being involved in at the time.
Tell us a little bit about the structure of your company. When you do an installation in Alaska, how many of your own employees do you have? Do you use local crews? How do you make it work?
Well, basically, we started out as a design, engineering, and equipment supply company. And in the last 6, 7, 8 years, we've gotten into the installation portion. If we do an installation generally overseas, Asia, or in Europe, South America, we generally will hire local contractors to do the concrete work, excavating, of course. We also work with the resorts to see how much of that they want to do in-house. We're very flexible. Our business model is a lot like the ski industry with lifts. They are flexible very often in allowing customers to self-perform some of the activities. So,
and you're headquartered here in Park City?
Yeah, well, we're actually in Wanship, and we operated out of three small homes out of Wanship. We live in Tollgate Canyon, have for 20 years. We're some of the longest full-time residents up there, but we operate our business out of homes in Wanship, very low overhead. We've just recently purchased a 21,000 square foot building in Colville. We're relocating right now. We'll be in about 3 weeks. And but yes, basically in this community.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Eric Silvik. He is the owner of Terra Nova, which is installing or has installed over the past decade or so many of the zip lines that you see here in Utah as well as throughout the world. Eric, I want to go back to a comment you made on the formation, or really remind the audience. Your company really started after September 11th. Which has been, what, now 2001, 17 years. And you just told our audience you're working currently out of several homes to keep overhead low. You're about to move into, did you say, 21,000 square feet? So it's really now that you're really feeling like, wow, we're really a company and, you know, we have an office to go to and that. That's 17 years is a long time. That's a long journey. What have you enjoyed most about that, and what are one or two of the biggest learnings from building a business that you've taken away from that 17 years?
Well, you know, I think this move into a larger facility is great just because it'll consolidate us. We do a lot of R&D, tremendous amount of R&D, trying to develop new products, refine the products we currently have. You know, the work out of the homes in Wanship was actually quite interesting. It was like a mini skunk works. You know, we had a bunch of us just thinking and building and creating things in this area and in this location. You know, we just recently designed and installed the evacuation system for the next manned space launch for NASA at Cape Canaveral. So we were bringing in astronauts and NASA folks and United Launch Alliance folks, Boeing, Lockheed Martin were all coming to these little buildings, little homes in Wanship. and we were proud of it because this is where we were creating these things. And they spent 2 years with another company trying to build a system. They built a prototype. It didn't work. Spent millions of dollars. We came in about 5 months and built the system. And
part of that is that Skunk Works, that we're a small company, we're scrappy, we get things done. Are you worried moving into this 21,000 square feet that you might lose that entrepreneurial spirit?
No, I think it provides us more space under roof. We can do a lot more indoor testing. We've got two products that are going to be introduced in 2019. This building is going to be pivotal in development of those products. And we're not growing by leaps and bounds. We're not hiring a huge amount of people yet, more than we have now. And we're relatively small. I mean, we have about, 6 to 10 people full time. We do a lot of work. We subcontract a lot of work out, machining and welding. So no, I'm not afraid of the building kind of taking away from our creativity.
And are there projects currently underway that you can tell us about around the world that where we'll see new installations of Zip Riders coming up?
Well, we're working in St. Louis right now at a really tiny ski area there. But yeah, we've developed an incredible system for them, so we're in the process of developing that. I just got word this morning I have to fly to Austria on Monday for a project at a ski area there, looking at a project there. I've probably analyzed 400 or 500 different resorts throughout the United States and the world. So what happens is these are relatively long lead times.
You're right.
And so we'll make these proposals. Most of the folks have no idea what we're going to present. Usually when they get our proposals, they're bigger, longer, crazier than they ever imagined. So sometimes it's an educational process to go, look, yeah, we can build a 7,000-foot zip line across this canyon, and it'll be great. And we've already done this before. So, it's an interesting process. We have just interesting projects.
Well, it sounds like it's been an interesting journey for you and your team, and it sounds like you guys are at a really nice inflection point. Very impressed that you're working with NASA on that escape system for the next generation of astronauts and all over the world. So congratulations. Our guest this morning has been Eric Silvik. He is the owner of Terra Nova in Utah, which is providing exhilarating zip lines as well as safety systems throughout the world. Eric, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. Please stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Joining the Park City Chamber Bureau is an inexpensive and smart investment for your business. Chamber Bureau members receive private access to advertising opportunities, referrals, educational and professional seminars, business-to-business events, and other exclusive resources to help businesses grow. The Park City Chamber Bureau supports over 1,000 area businesses, both large and small. More info at visitparkcity.com or 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
This is Brooks Arbertson, commercial lender for Mountain West Bank, sponsor of the amazing programming on KPCW. At Mountain West Bank, we offer consumer loan options as well as home loans and business loans in one location. Mountain West Bank, just off Kearns, next to the theaters. MountainWestBank.com, division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hi, this is Steve Roney, owner of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. I'm a proud resident of Park City and a loyal supporter of KPCW and all it does for our community. Our agents in Summit and Wasatch counties can be reached at any of our 30 offices or at our website, bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our next guest today is Ben Castro, who is a vice president of Zions Bank. Thank you for joining us. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Roger. How are you?
Good. Ben, I guess I wanted to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about the role of private banking at Zions and what's going on in that part of the industry now.
So our role as private bankers is we are not only kind of coordinators for our clients that are high wealth individuals, but we kind of help guide and direct and kind of do a high touch where we are there basically the branch for the individuals, and so they come and talk to us about their different needs, and we talk about the different not only lending but estate planning, investments, really a whole gamut of different items to fit their needs on a daily basis.
And what does it take to qualify to be a private client of Zions?
So with us, basically, we have a limitation of we ask that the individuals make at least $200,000 a year and have net worth of $3 million. I know with some of our different competitors that are out there, they require that you have to have assets actually managed by the institution, and that's not, you know, our case. We really want to just try and create a high value for our clients and, you know, give them maybe the service that they haven't seen elsewhere.
And with the sort of onset of various kinds of online services in the financial industry, how do you see the future of an institution like Zions? I mean, is the role of private banking to try to come up with, you know, sort of a service that you can't get by talking to the computer?
You know, I think that's the biggest thing that separates what we may do versus others. You know, online, anyone can go and open a trading account. Anyone can open an account online. But I think that individual point of contact, the, you know, the needs base. So, you know, they call a phone number and they talk to an individual instead of, you know, a robot and, you know, trying to figure out how to even get around an 800 system.
Ben, let me ask you and really build on Roger's question. All this automation that's taking place in our industry, what do you think's led to the growth in this kind of automatic advising, automatic investing, what we in the industry call robo-advising, robo-investing? Why do you think it's gotten the traction that it has?
I think the main reason it has, Doug, is based off of we're a society that just wants quick results and quick answers and dig to basically take the order in the drive-up line and move on. But then, you know, the funny thing is with money, when there's a problem, you want someone to be able to go to and fix the problem instead of having to correspond via email and maybe not get the level of satisfaction or the level of need that is required in something that's very complicated and very sensitive to everyone. I mean, everyone has money issues and everyone wants to make sure that their money's protected. And I think that's where we come in, and that's where there's a little difference versus just your order taking.
I think that's a good point. And I particularly like your point about, you know, when there's challenges, are you really going to be comfortable having an automatic system, or do you want somebody that spent their career and their life building an expertise in that area to help guide you through the challenging periods? And, you know, one of the things that's interesting is the robo-advisor, the robo-investing has really grown in a period where the market has overall done quite well. And the question is, what happens when the market has a hiccup, when the market at some point in the future is going to definitely have a 10% correction? More than likely, it will have a 20% correction at some point. And what happens to people that are with these automatic solutions and don't have a human on their side? How does Zions think about the service side of the equation for private client services? How many families are you working with, Ben?
You know, I deal with basically about 300 different families/clients, and we have another private banker that covers not only Park City and Heber, and then we just added our third as we're continuing to see, you know, some affluence continue to come into the Wasatch back. There's an incredible need and demand, and, you know, we're seeing you know, lots of individuals that are in their mid to late 50s sell their companies and want to, you know, retire and have that basically mindset and, you know, security that things are going to be taken care of for them. And I think, you know, if anything, that's one of the things that we really strive on is our service. And, you know, we really take a look at it, you know, even on the investment side, where we're a fiduciary, and as a fiduciary investment company, we're consistently looking out for the best needs. So going back to your point about, you know, the robo-investing, you know, when the market does make that market correction, you know, who's going to help those individuals figure out the best place to safe haven their money. And I think that's one of the things that we really work hard on.
Ben, does Dyons have a product sort of for individuals with slightly less sort of assets than the full private banking?
So we do have a separate group that is those individuals that are basically coming into their careers or coming into some affluence, which is our executive banking division. And those individuals help out as well. We have executive bankers. We have three amazing executive bankers on the Wasatch Back, one at Heber, one at our location in Snow Creek, and one at New Park. And they do a very good job of helping those individuals get to a certain point and then working with them to transition them to our private banking department and just continue to build on that relationship.
Our guest this morning has been Ben Castro. He's a vice president of Zions Bank. Ben, thank you for joining us. And I also want to say thank you to Zions Bank. You guys do a lot of outreach in the community. I think Zions has helped support many of the not-for-profits here in town and many of the things that make living in Park City and living in Utah special. They're great supporters of the arts. And I want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Doug and Roger.
Stay tuned to Mountain Money. Roger and I will wrap up the show right after these words from our underwriters.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Rimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. That was a fun show today and great guests. We want to thank them. They include Cal Turner, the author of My Father's Business, Eric Silvik, who's with Terra Nova, building zip lines throughout the world and also safety systems for NASA. And then our final guest we just had online was Ben Castro, vice president of Zions Bank.
I also want to thank our sponsors, Mountain West Bank, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Development with Verdian and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
So, Roger, I want to transition to another subject in a second, but before we get there, just really fascinating story, hearing the start of Dollar General. Really enjoyed hearing from Cal kind of the beginnings of that company.
It's an interesting book, and as I said earlier today, parts of it read like a novel between the sort of showdowns with his father, the showdowns with his brother, the incredibly dark and confrontational issues with the Teamsters Union, and then finally we didn't talk about this with the guest because it's a touchy subject, finally the SEC investigation that ultimately led to him having to leave the company.
Lots of different chapters in that story, and it was great having Cal as a guest. Breaking news came out this morning. The Supreme Court ruled on a very big case where there was a baker, I believe it was in Colorado Springs, that said, hey, I don't want to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the baker, which frankly surprised me. Roger, you're an attorney. I wanted to get your thoughts on that ruling.
Well, the interesting thing that leaps out at you when you hear about the ruling is that it was a 7-2 and not a 5-4. So what that means is that several members of the so-called liberal group also sided with the baker. Now, the decision was, and again, I haven't read the decision. I've read some of the coverage because it just came out a few minutes ago. Justice Kennedy wrote the decision, and what he said was, look, the religious convictions of the baker should have been taken into account in a balancing, and that the state of Colorado, they just were hostile to his religious issues. And we also went on to say that in the future, it may be that different decisions would be made, but that he had a right to have at least a neutral consideration of his religious convictions, and that's why they sent it back.
Okay, well, interesting update there. Thank you for sharing that with us. We've got a couple seconds left. Just a brief update on the weather. The weather's supposed to be beautiful. It's going to warm up. It was nice and cool over the weekend. Thank you for joining us here on Mountain Money, and thank you for listening to KPCW Park City. NPR News is next.